Just a word of warning that the following episode will contain discussion and descriptions of sex and sexuality, bodily fluids, decaying corpses, murder, torture, animal distress, and very bad vampire impressions. So enjoy, if you can.
Sarah, hit us with some Babylonia.
Greetings and welcome to Vessels of Kingsgrave. And welcome to the third episode of Creature Chat, where we discuss all manner of creatures. And tonight we will be discussing the most beautiful and regal of all the children of the night, the vampire. I will be the conductor of tonight's festivities. The men of your country call me Peter, but I am also known as Shellfish. Joining me, we have the Lord Baron.
Good evening. I am the Lord Baron.
Welcome, Lord Baron. And what is your blood type?
I actually don't know.
Mine's A+, like none of my grades. And also joining we have Dr. Blood.
I don't know what's happening. Hi, everybody. It's the appropriately named Dr. Blood and Sarah in real life.
And what is your blood type?
I believe it is also A+, like many of my grades.
Very good, very good. And also joining us, we have Monroe Jack 2.
Hello, Monroe Jack 2 on the forums. Very pale and allergic to sunlight in real life.
You'll fit right in then. And what is your blood type?
I don't know either.
That is unfortunate, but we shall move on.
And maybe also join.
I am sorry, what was that? Can you repeat it?
Maybe tasty. I don't know.
Oh, it is certainly tasty. And also joining us, we have Desi Mormont.
Hi, it's Abby. I do not know my blood type. Yeah.
And Lord Varley.
Hey guys, Matt in real life. Don't know my blood type. This is weird.
And last of all, we have the Tall.
Greetings, kindred. It is I, Patrick the Tall, and my blood type, I think, is Viking.
Viking. So, a vintage from the cold north. Okay, well, I think that's enough of the voice for now, so I think we can go into our discussion on vampires today. So, as usual, we'll start with a bit of an introduction and definition. So, let's start by defining vampires. So, please tell me, what is a vampire?
Well, first of all, sucking blood. Blood, right? That's
or it could be an emotional vampire too.
So a vampire is a bloodsucker.
Damn you, Colin Robinson.
Colin Robinson.
A creature of the night.
It's a night creature.
It's really just a parasite, isn't it? Something that lives off of a living thing and, you know, just kind of moves along once it kills that living thing host.
Maybe. I mean, a vampire bat doesn't necessarily kill the livestock that it feeds upon, but it's still...
They get infections from those bites, friend.
Yeah, they can die, but not from, you know, getting sucked upon, necessarily.
But, like, but, okay.
Can we just isolate Patrick saying sucked upon?
Okay, but so does a vampire, in the terms of, like, the monster that we're talking about, do they always have to kill their like, prey, too? Like, I feel like that's the most, like, mainstream is, like, they'll either kill their prey or, like, turn them into a vampire. But there's never, like, a, oh, let me just, you know, chew on that arm for a little bit and then, you know, you can go out about your day.
Well, in Dracula, it was a protracted process, right? Like, I mean, the first few times she didn't, I'm thinking about Mina, she didn't die and she wasn't exsanguinated. Like, she just was very languid and kind of anemic.
Yeah, but Dracula was all like, had to be pervy in Victorian times and like how women were sexual beings to be preyed upon.
Yeah. I don't know that they do always kill. I mean, I'm thinking like folklorically, I feel like there are a lot of descriptions of like, man, this vampire came up and bit me. You know what I mean? So like, they're, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily.
What voice was that?
That was the Deep South vampire.
Well, I mean, like, I think
long ago village.
That's my folklore voice. Apologies.
Yeah. Oh yeah, a vampire Don bit me.
Well, that is in True Blood. It's like the vampire bale.
Yeah, like in What We Do in the Shadows, and I think in other places there's like familiars or like, you know, the mortal people that like kind of set shit up for the vampire.
Yeah, like cattle,
kind of like a living god or something.
Like they might have the servant that they can feed upon and not kill them or turn them, but I think there's usually like some kind of implication that it's addictive to the person being fed upon as well, and they form that sort of like kind of enthrallment in some way, some situations, I guess.
Well, like I feel like a lot of the, or not a lot, but just like off the top of my head, I guess the implication is they're either gonna like kill you, and if they don't kill you, you turn into a vampire. So that, I don't know, maybe that's Twilight rules and that's what I'm thinking of. I honestly don't know.
They usually kill just to cover their tracks. I mean, I feel like it's a lot harder to hide who and what you are if you're leaving, you know, perforated just, people all over the.
Yeah, it's just like in the Confessions of a Vampire, right? Where they, I don't think they necessarily have to kill the person, although the people who get fed upon are definitely know what's up as soon as, you know, the ecstasy mulls over.
What are you referencing?
Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, I thought you said Confessions of a Vampire.
Oh, yeah, I probably did. Let's mix it up because it's something else in Danish.
Confessions of a Teenaged Vampire.
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, no, like Lestat and stuff like that, they don't necessarily have to kill them, but they have to kill them to cover their tracks, basically, I think.
Well, isn't it just like a desire for power that you don't have, whether it's like, you know, political power or like wealth or being a vampire, like you have sycophants that'll do things for you?
Yeah, I mean, about that, like feeding on people and whether it has to kill them or turn them into a vampire, I feel like a common variant and one that I like personally is that they sort of have to bless a victim to turn them into a vampire, usually by giving them their vampire's blood, sort of like sometimes they call that the blood kiss, or like when they sire young from people rather than just feeding on them. I feel like that's common in fantasy at least.
Yeah, I mean, modern vampire myths pretty much go that way for most of them. And, the most well-known role-playing game in that sort of setting is Vampire the Masquerade, and that there you have to drain the victim completely and then, you know, feed them your own vitae, as it's called, your own vampire blood. And that's, I think, it's basically lifted off Anne Rice's books, so...
No, I was just saying I do agree with that in the sense of modern vampire stories is kind of lifting from that Anne Rice, because I do base like a lot of my ideas off of Anne Rice vampires, but obviously that changes depending on the situation.
And that's the movie with Angelina Jolie's husband, right?
Yeah, ex-husband. Yeah.
Ex-husband, yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of beautiful people in that movie.
Yes, Antonio Banderas. Yeah, he looks very nice in that movie.
Okay, I think we can probably move on from definition into sort of like early history or like asking when have vampires began or like where is the sort of genesis of this myth of this creature? What's the earliest depiction of a vampire you guys can think of?
Sarah, hit us with some Babylonia.
What? Rude. Oh, I thought you were...
I thought you were saying Sarah was.
Yeah, I mean they're not as readily identifiable as vampires, I don't think, but there are sort of like night demons that have a lot of these characteristics in common. Like there's the Lamia and the Dragi, I think, in ancient Greece. And like Lilith and like those kind of characters. So, but they tend to be female, which is an interesting dynamic that maybe we could talk about where there's a point at which that this nighttime seducer becomes primarily male. I've also been doing a lot of reading about succubi and incubi and demonology in the Middle Ages, which is super interesting and also super weird.
And then has a lot of overlap with vampires as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Is there any like connection or whatever between that, but you just answered.
Yeah, I mean the medieval incubi and succubi started out as like those lamia or the lemurs is another word for them, which kind of like King Julian'd me a little bit in a way that I wasn't expecting. But yeah, the demonological like metaphysics of the incubus become really, really important in discussions of the limits of angelic and demonic power in the Middle Ages, like whether they can actually generate stuff and create stuff, which is a little bit off topic, but yeah, the idea that there are these
there's sexual element to them strongly as well as there is with vampires.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that they come, you know, to get it on while you're sleeping.
And are those like succubus and incubus myths tied to sleep paralysis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, like the nightmare idea.
Yeah, they're closely related in some of the discussions.
No, they're real demons that come to you at night and steal your life force, whether it's your blood or your seed. Doy.
Well, that's exactly right. I was gonna say like they come to steal semen so that they can then implant it in women and create like astrologically naughty children, I guess. Like they do it at exactly the right time and exactly the right. So they
what is a astrologically naughty child?
I couldn't think of it. But the like ones whose horoscopes predestine them to be nefarious, I guess, is maybe this. So they choose the precise moment and the precise astrological conjunctions to create children who will like further their nefarious ends on.
Is that like Attila the Hun or like someone like infamous like that or just like, you know.
That's a great question. Yeah, there were actually legends in the Middle Ages that the Huns were descended from this kind of incubus succubus. It was like a whole generation of like incubus succubus relationships, and so like that is one of the primary pieces of evidence in the Middle Ages for the fact that demons could do this, because they were like, look, like they said this is what happened with the Huns and like how they were created. And also Merlin was another like major piece of evidence where they were like, well, Merlin was born from a demon. So anyway. This is not really about vampires, but the point is that they used to steal.
Well, it all sort of blends together. Like, isn't Merlin also kind of tied to fairies in a way? Or I mean, there's a lot of overlap with demons. And
I thought he was a mentally disabled bard or something.
Sarah, you posted the chart in hold on, let me rephrase this and use English. In the chart that you posted in the chat, it mentions like Chinese folklore, and I'm sure this is you. I'm not expecting you to know anything about this because it's like different from your area of expertise, but do you know if there's like a difference in how vampires are portrayed in like East Asian folklore? Because I didn't even know that they kind of existed in that, or like if they have kind of the same, you know, they're this like sexual thing that's trying to like, I don't know if you know what I'm saying.
I can answer that, Sarah, if you want to defer.
I would love to.
So there is a movie that I forget what the title is, but it's a Vietnamese movie about vampires, and all they do is hop around and they chase you like.
Bong Joon Ho, not Bong. Is that what his name is? The guy who did Parasite. That's a Korean movie.
No, this one's like 30 years old.
Are you? Because they also just hop around.
I think the general thing they consume is the chi, the life force, instead of actual blood. But depending on what sort of setting it is, I think some of them have actually been like consumed it through blood, but it's like the chi they want instead, in Chinese and Japanese folklore at least.
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like a lot of those sort of earlier kind of blood sucking or life stealing monsters, like there might be kind of an intangible element to them, that they might be more like ghosts that hunger for life, and they come and sort of steal your essence in a way that doesn't necessarily leave any marks.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think that it seems to be, whether it's semen or whether it's chi or whether it's blood, it seems to be whatever the culture that generates them considers to be the kind of quintessential life force, right? Like whatever it is that is the most important essence, as you said, like for who,
yeah,
for
yeah,
who so you are.
Like, yeah, does like the blood go back to like the humors or whatever that they believed in then?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, basically, in China at least, they believe that if you align the chi correctly with the acupuncture and stuff like that, that you can heal people's maladies to some extent at least. So yeah, there's definitely something like that in it. Also, when you say that, Sarah, about the life force, it connects very well to back to the whole females being the primary blood gods or vampires to begin with at least. Since they are, you know, in a lot of old mythology, like connected to life force and, you know, primeval forces. So it makes a lot of sense that women would be cast as the primary vampires to begin with, at least.
Yeah, there was a lot of anxiety in the Middle Ages that losing seed would be losing essence or losing energy, because they considered it, and Aristotle considered it to be the most refined form of blood, so it took a lot of energy to make, and then once it was taken away, it was like a significant loss.
Well, isn't that why people were not ready to cut their hair? Like, that's what set the Romans apart so much, because just leaving that little bit of yourself left you vulnerable to spells and curses and shit. Like, the Vikings trimmed all their toenails and they became that boat that all the warriors came back on in Ragnarok.
I love that boat. Nagelarg? Come on,
Pat. Yeah, but you had to dispose of your toenails or whatever, fingernails, in a specific way, so they couldn't be used to curse you, and they'd be added to the boat.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a sense of, like, possession, right, or ownership if you get a hold of something so important to somebody. Like,
Nagelfar.
Nagelfar. Let's all try to say it. Nagelfar.
Nagelfar.
It actually,
like the Naglerim.
No, Nagel is
necklace
actually
of
nail.
The dwarves.
Nagel is actually nail. It's directly lifted. So it's like faring, like having a fair or a travel with on nails. So quite simple.
is that where fairy comes from?
Yeah, also.
All right. So it's a toenail fairy. I love it.
Yeah.
is that like Wayfarer or from? Like...
The Tooth Fairy's way less cooler cousin.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that what you said about the Lamia and Strigoi and stuff like that, that's, and Lilith as well, it's interesting because they do sort of weave that into a lot of, like, modern vampire lore or backstory in stories that have vampires. And then I know at least in the Warhammer Fantasy universe, Lamia is a type of vampire, and Strigoi is as well. And I think in a lot of stories, they sort of base that Lilith was the first vampire, and maybe they make Cain one of the first vampires as well.
Okay, just if you want to go completely into a nerd lore, Vampire the Masquerade again has like a alternative origin story. Normally, it would be Cain cursed by God. That would be the prime vampire, the first vampire. But there are people who believe that Lilith is the first vampire, being cursed by God first. And she basically taught Cain everything that he knows in that universe. They're very, very Judeo-centric. that lore in there.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah. That, like, non-Judeo-Christian, more earlier societies had some kind of version of this. I think it just comes from, like, the anxiety of not knowing where sickness and plague comes from.
Yeah, that's a good point. We can go into that more now, that sort of, like, the possible origin, or, like, why do we tell these stories of blood-sucking fiends that steal your life force? And like, I think on the show notes, somebody mentioned porphyria and rabies and tuberculosis and other diseases like that.
Yeah, for like the stuff that I wanted to talk about with the New England vampire panic, it's almost all tuberculosis. But with porphyria, anemia, there's a number of other diseases. But I think it even goes back to like lizard brain kind of stuff of like, beware of what's beyond like the firelight because you're no longer protected. And, you know, to drive it home, you can tell tales of the things that lurk in the night, the night walkers and such.
Is the rabies then also connected to the, like, part of how the bats got their connection beyond the vampire bat? Like, because I know bats are a big worry with rabies. So is that something too that was like, oh, vampires can turn into bats, so be, you know, careful around bats so you don't get rabies, but actually so you don't turn into a vampire or get killed?
That's interesting.
I think that correlation makes sense.
Yeah, like, I don't know if bats actually carry a lot of rabies, but that's what I've heard all the time growing up is, like, do not approach the bats. The bats have rabies.
Well, that's because this asshole named Stephen King likes to scare everyone over everything, and he wrote a book called Cujo where the dog goes absolutely insane after being bitten by rabid bats.
Oh, is that what happens with Cujo? I just assumed it was demons.
Oh, no, he chases, like, a rabbit down a rabbit hole, but it ends up being a cave, and all he sees is these little tiny red eyes attacking his face, and he goes mad. Yeah. I don't know why I remember that. Holy shit, that recall of the book that I read, like, 30 years ago.
According to the CDC, most bats don't have rabies. But Quebec says to be careful of bats because they can give you rabies. So, who's right?
Where are, like, real vampire bats at, though? Like a new world species of bat that they don't exist in Europe, or do they? Like blood-drinking bats?
Yeah, they're from South America, I think.
Yeah, I thought they were, like, all along the tropics, but you might be...
Yeah, right. Central and South America is what Wikipedia says.
Oh. Sorry, welcome to Bat Talk. Go ahead, Peter.
That just makes me think that maybe the real-life vampire bats couldn't have acted as inspiration for vampires if they were only discovered by Europeans, like, as recently as when people from Europe got to South and Central America.
I know, or at least my understanding is that a lot of the Western European folkloric characteristics of vampires align with what happens to a corpse in a grave, right? So they're, like, bloated and kind of dusky, and, like, even the long fingernails, like, I guess when a corpse is starting to decompose, the skin recedes, and so it looks like the teeth and the fingernails are getting longer, when
but
in fact
not
it's
only
just
that. Yeah, so the skin shrinks, so that mm-hmm. it appears like the fingernails grow, and mm-hmm. that's the same thing happens on the scalp, so it looks like the hair grows, but also all these, like, disgusting gases start going in, so, like, you can move them, and they can actually reverberate off the vocal cords, so they can give, like, a death rattle, and when you, like, stab a stake in their heart, they could go, because all the gases are escaping, also, because you start turning, like, gooey, like, things will, like, start oozing out of your mouth, like, blood.
Oh, so it looks like you have blood, like...
So, like, they, like, open up this, like, corpse, and, oh, God, I think I broke Abby.
Sorry, what?
Yeah, I think we maybe need to put a content warning on this episode that there's going to be graphic descriptions of decomposing corpses.
No,
but
because you put
and,
up
like,
the
gases also made them change position in the grave. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's also, like, a thing. And so I just won't do the New England thing. But one of the last people in the New England panic, they obviously couldn't bury bodies when the ground was frozen. So they would look at these bodies that look perfectly preserved because they're idiots and it's just so cold that of course they're perfectly preserved. And they wouldn't realize that like 6 months in a New England winter didn't lead to any decay, so they must be vampires. And yeah, a lot of it's just humans being the fucking dumbest people ever sometimes.
Yeah, I could say something very religiously inflammatory about what happens when people die and Jesus, but I will not because I don't want to offend anyone. No, but I remembered what I was thinking with vampires and bats is because I think I remember being told that bats and vampires weren't connected until Dracula came out. The connection between bats is like quite recent, actually. So it would have been after European contact with North America and South America.
Well, Europe has bats. I think it's something very like gothic and about that like genre, like
Connection.
Yeah, definitely. Like gargoyles have.
But the connection between like vampires and bats was like not really a thing until the 1800s. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. But there are a lot of other creatures that suck blood, like mosquitoes and leeches and ticks and bed bugs and those kinds of things, but we don't really. I mean, I suppose in some modern depictions they do try to use those blood-sucking creatures with vampires, like in the video game Darkest Dungeon. They have more sort of tick and mosquito-like vampires, but I think that's very much the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. So a thing that I, when you talk about it, we have to like differentiate between the Victorian ages vampires and what we might call just the modern vampires, and the pre-historic vampires maybe, or just like the pre-Victorian ages vampires, because it depends on it. Like in all monsters, I would say is a morality thing, where it's sort of changed with the story. To be something have to be more scary. I'm not making much sense right now. Okay, so the thing I want to say is that in Victorian ages, the story was not so much more that you had to bury your dead to make sure that they stay down. It's more like there is something greater and more evil out there, more powerful than you, and probably more intelligent than you, that you should be afraid of. You need to purport yourself in a proper manner, unless you want to get preyed upon by something dark in the night. Whilst that was not the story to begin with, like with Draugr or other sorts of vampires, it's more like
so that sort of don't go in the woods, little child kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a morality tale, as it ends up in from Victorian ages. While before it was much more, you need to bury that thing. Unless you want to get killed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is practical as well. You do want to bury your dead so you don't get diseases of them and stuff like that.
I think there's also a very, I don't know, I think in some of the early folklore, there's a tension between like wanting to remember your elders and your ancestors, and also like wanting them not to be your fucking problem anymore when your family is starving, which is like kind of a weird balance. But there's a sense that in some of the very earliest iterations that of like vampires proper, that they return to prey explicitly on their own family. So there's almost a sense of like resource dearth where, you know, like grandpa has passed on and like we don't have to feed and care for him anymore, but like, oh wait, grandpa's back and he's literally eating us in our home, you know.
Let me speak to that too.
Okay.
Please do, Matt, please do.
So especially with tuberculosis, which is highly infectious, and especially when people tended to sleep in the same room or lived in, you know, 1 to 2 room houses, communicable diseases would spread even more. So usually they dig up the first person that died, because things like tuberculosis, you know, would spread and then other people would get sick. And sometimes there's a real quick sickness and sometimes it was like real prolonged. So whenever that happened, it would take out like a whole family. So they'd assume that like the first person died. So in one of the last things in New England was this girl, Mary, was the first person that died. they couldn't bury her, so she was perfectly preserved. Her brother Edwin got sick with tuberculosis, and they took out Mary's heart. They made it, burned it into ashes, and then made Edwin eat it so he would not get sick and the spell of the vampire would be broken. And it worked for about 2 weeks until he died of TB.
Wow.
Oh, that's like, that's very, like, not what you would expect from such recent history, that you would think that.
That was sort of 1892, and that was in Rhode Island, New England, Exeter. There's a cemetery there that's supposed to be haunted, and Mary's headstone is supposed to glow green in high school, and it doesn't. but yes, so around that time, Bram Stoker, it's said that a newspaper clipping of that story was found in his notes for Dracula that was written 3 years after and published 5 years afterwards.
No, that's cool that they can find that, like, reverse engineer what, I mean, I think we all probably think the Dracula is like the thing that popularized this vampire myth in our modern times, I suppose, and that there's like actual sicknesses that have contributed to that story. Have you guys read Dracula?
No, I have not.
Neither have I.
If it makes you feel any better, one time I was talking to my AP English teacher in high school, and I told her I didn't read, like, this was the last day of school, like, when, after I had graduated or whatever, and I was like, just so you know, I don't think I read a single book for your class. And she was like, that's okay. When I was getting my graduate degree, I, instead of reading Dracula, I watched the movie and wrote a paper on it, and then my professor said, please read the book next time. So,
yeah, that'll happen. They'll call you right the fuck out.
Even my English teacher didn't read Dracula.
It's a weird style.
I read it like 100 years ago.
Yeah, like it's very much in like the author Conan Doyle, where the first half is all of Harker's diary, so it's hard to get into when it's like kind of presented in that style. But it's a good book.
Yeah, and that's something I really liked about it too. Almost that like journaling kind of style. And then, yeah, like you're saying, kind of like the Arthur Conan Doyle style too, where it's almost kind of the same way that they would do like weeklies or the Penny Dreadful kind of stories too.
Penny Dreadful's on Netflix for anyone who hasn't watched that show. It's excellent.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's a good show. I like it. Like the monstrous form of the vampires.
I know what you meant. But
I'm always struck by these very like foundational works of Gothic literature, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was another one for me, where they're so huge in Western consciousness. And then like whenever I finally sat down to read any of that Gothic or like Edgar Allan Poe stories and stuff, you're like, what the fuck is that? You know, like it's just, they're not like, I don't know. They weren't as scary,
very unlike their sort of predecessors, like the stuff that came after them, like
the canon versus fanon dilemma.
I guess maybe that's what it I don't know, they just feel so much more like localized to me, like in time and place, than I was expecting. So like Dracula is like very, very specific, like Transylvania, and then they go to like the New World, you know, but it just doesn't feel as sort of universally resonant as I expected going into it to have generated this long-standing mythos.
Well, Frankenstein's another one that's like very different.
Yes, yeah,
yeah. Absolutely. Frankenstein's like he builds him a wife or something, and I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, and then he like, yeah, it's,
well,
just,
I mean, Bride of Frankenstein is pretty, it's,
yeah, but
a,
like the
like
just
thing as well.
The actual plot of Frankenstein is like, you're, because I remember I had to read this book and I was just like, what the fuck is happening? Like how did this become so fundamental in our like creature lore?
Yeah, Frankenstein is a whiny bitch. Like it's
No, he's a very loving person who's rejected by society because he doesn't adhere to their concept of beauty.
Not Frankenstein. That's monster. Not Frankenstein. Yeah, that's the monster.
Frankenstein is
check
a whiny
yourself.
Bitch. Right, I'm on team monster all the way, man. That guy read Paradise Lost and actually understood what he was reading. So he's already a step ahead of most people I know.
Like the Frankenstein's monster or the creation in the book is so different from the pop culture depiction of it. It was very stark, the contrast between them when I actually read Frankenstein.
Okay, I'm just thinking that if we can try to distill what all these stories try to tell us, not necessarily. Like, yes, you said Frankenstein's monster is like misunderstood. It doesn't conform and it gets ostracized and then killed, right? That's a real fear for a lot of people, even nowadays, right?
I would argue that it's
isn't
actually killed. It's actually man turning I think both Frankenstein and Dracula as books hinge on this anxiety between modern and historic ways of thinking, whether it's like with Frankenstein where we're going through a scientific revolution and kind of you want to kill God, you want to kill your creator, and that's what the monster eventually does. He chases, the doctor through the Arctic, and that's where we meet them on the boat in the very beginning. And Dracula is the very same thing, where you have this Victorian industrialized England going through, about to enter the 1900s, this like turn of the century kind of era, while you're still looking back at these peasant, like folkloric characters like Dracula.
But that's like a characteristic of romantic literature, where it's like all about nature and how like man can't conquer nature, because that was the whole thing, was like neo-Gothic. Everything was like all their art and everything was, the nature was overriding the human invention and stuff. Because like you said, there's all this anxiety about all the industrialization and everything. So the like lessons we're supposed to learn is like we have to let nature do its thing. And, like, we can't always try to be conquering that.
Yeah, the force that's larger than you, the primeval force, that's what I was trying to get at with the vampires. I think that there's something that you cannot fight because it's bigger, stronger, and more intelligent than you. And that's what vampires are in modern lore.
I think it's especially interesting in Dracula because he makes that overseas move, right? Like so it's not only the contrast between the feudal European countryside and the industrialized European cities, but it's also, translated over into the New World and like, can the Americans handle this? And, bringing them into this kind of like, new frontier or final frontier into this generations old conflict of old and new, right? It's like a whole nother dimension to it that comes out in the second half, which I think is really interesting.
But it's also a rejection of, what came before romanticism? Classicism? I don't remember, but it's like a rejection against like pristine and like perfection and stuff. Like I just always think of the gardens that they had at their houses where they would all just let everything get overgrown and like it was like all like Greek Roman architecture but like crumbled and stuff. And so it's this rejection against the antiquity. Also, it's very strange. So I guess it is like putting a new spin on old ideas, which I guess worked.
It's almost like reverse nostalgia in some way, where like you're looking at it, but like its value is in the fact that it's past, not that you wish it would come around again.
Yeah, and Dracula lives in this like old dilapidated castle as well. And he's like ancient evil, I suppose, that like reaches out for us from there.
Yeah. I do think it's really interesting that his, with Polidori and Bram Stoker, like one of the major shifts was a basically like a socioeconomic one, like a class shift, right? So from being peasant grandpa in peasant village, it's suddenly this like super erudite, super wealthy, top of the feudal food chain kind of. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that like there's a power dynamic to it that gets linked in the same moment with like a sexual power dynamic, which is
like the idle rich just feeding on the people below them and not contributing anything.
Yeah, so, like almost like a conspicuous consumption kind of absolutely.
So I think that's also what you want to get at if you want to think about vampires from that era, is that it was like only 100 years ago since a lot of the places in Europe got democracy. Stuff like that we went away from the aristocracy actually owning everything and deciding everything for you. I think it's so recent, like you would retell that story of the old powers that would own you basically I think that's a valid thing to take into account when you think about why people were afraid of vampires, because they're everything that we've gotten away from, but might get into again if you let, you know, capitalism and whatever take over.
I think super interesting, because it is like, because you have like the nouveau riche in that time, the industrialists that are just becoming, you know, replacing the aristocracy to a large part, but like still they hold this like ancient, like unholdable power that the nouveau riche just can never possess, no matter how much money they have.
Well, exactly. And fascinatingly, that's dictated by blood, isn't it? By
Yep.
Excellent. Yeah, there's a lot of that imagery of nobility, of like fancy clothes and balls and castles and like decadence and luxury and stuff like that. It's tied to vampires very often.
I think too, like historically, Gilles de Rais is a good representation of that kind of predatory aristocracy, and so is Elizabeth Bathory, right? Or Elizabeth Bathory.
Sorry, what was that first name?
Gilles de Rais. I'm sure I'm saying it barbarically, but they think he was the origin for Bluebeard, but he was an infamous French nobleman who was a serial abuser and murderer of peasant children, right? So he was overtly predatory, but I just posted that thing. But in that same, like he's not tied directly to vampire lore as Elizabeth Bathory is, but it's a similar dynamic where, like, you know, peasant children and young women keep disappearing and nobody really questions it because, like, they're probably disappearing in the aristocrat's direction, but like there's nothing to be done because of this predatory social structure.
But it's definitely a connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to say too, to tie everything we've just been talking about all together, is like part of the nature of I think what really popularized Dracula, or more truthfully, what came after it, is not only is it like the coming to terms with a new world, a modern world, but then also coming to terms, because as the world becomes more modern, you're able to go more introspective. So it's also a comment on like the innate fear of what maybe bad or evil you're capable of, and then especially tying to like Elizabeth Bathory and stuff like that, like the true evil nature, like humans possess inside. Yeah.
And the shadow and all that stuff, like, and it's kind of like, because I think as consumers of vampire fiction, we do also play with the idea of being the vampire ourselves, and like that sort of just embracing that darker side and just being evil and feeding on people, and it's kind of fun to indulge that kind of darkness in ourselves, I suppose.
Peter, are you confessing to being a vamp kid?
I'm not part of that subculture, but I do see the appeal.
See, I never hissed at people.
Did you just say vamp kid? What is that?
A vamp kid is like an offshoot of like the goth scene cult subculture. They dress like scene kids, but they're like all about vampires. Honestly, I just know it from South Park, so like my understanding of it is probably not great, but it was like really popular when the Twilight books came out, so it's quite new.
Because I know like when I was in high school, there's like a club, vampire clubs kind of scene, where it's really weird, like it they'd have like raves in New York City and like have syringes full of each other's blood, and it was a big concern.
What the fuck?
Because like AIDS was still a thing.
Oh, it was a big concern. I wonder why.
I mean, when I was in high school, it was like definitely after all of that. So we had like none of that shit. There were like a couple people that dressed like a little goth and were like really into like Wiccan, but we had passed over the vampire phase.
There's a good representation of that subculture in the Preacher series with the Les Enfants du Sang. Like there's a very like aggressively formed vampire club, I guess is maybe the best way to say it. But I don't remember much about them because it's been a while since I read it. But
so I think I actually found a website from 1995 that lists vampire act bars throughout the United States.
God, that's amazing.
I mean, look at just guys. The name is vampirewebsite.net. It looks like it was
the This is an Angel Fire website. Like, wow.
This is beautiful. Does it list the titty twister?
Click on your state below to get the club listings. All right, what's going on in Illinois? Ooh. We got Exit, Neo, and Nocturna in Chicago. Ooh, Energy Vampire is the first listing.
Neo and a letter from a real more, unfortunately.
There is actually a club in Montreal. It's called Fufine Electronique, which means electronic pussy, and they do like an emo night every month. And I guess that would be our closest vibe.
So the people like dress in that sort of vampire aesthetic there.
Yeah, you would dress up as like more like scene. I the scene vamp aesthetic is the same to me, so.
Okay. Well, I in Denmark, I haven't seen a real vampire bar where you actually like draw blood from people. But we do have a lot of LARPing, vampire LARPing, where you would actually sometimes have like this time we're just going to a bar and everyone needs to be in full kit. Otherwise, you're not getting in. So that would sometimes be interesting to see like people all being dressed up as vampires, not you know, thinking that they are or liking to draw blood in actuality, but still, you know, going full vampire.
Yeah, it's definitely something that resonates with some people very strongly, I suppose.
I think the stories are a pretty clear illustration of the end limits of, like, if you refuse to let society's morals or expectations define your behavior, right? So Dracula is very heavily like sexually deviant in a number of different ways, and or at least by, you know, Victorian standards. And so it's, you know, if you had the status and the station and the power and the resources not to be constrained by what society is expecting of you. So I can definitely see that as like, yeah, a very powerful expression of individuality on some level.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah. It's kind of almost like the idea of the Nietzschean Superman, like with their physical capabilities in these stories, that they are basically like tigers or lions in a world of sheep, and they just can like, it's like a power fantasy that you can just do whatever you want and nobody is able to stop you. And but that also has its appeal, I suppose.
Yeah, there are also people who like the idea of a vampire, you know, the reverse power fantasy, you know, where you hope that some point someone will come in and take your freedom from you and make all the decisions for you, and you will be swept up in something larger than themselves. So it acts very well into that. And as we know, power is, you know, is being sexy. If you're powerful, you're automatically more sexy than someone who isn't. At least, more attractive, at least.
Yeah, and I think you see that kind of being displayed in, like, for example, like the Lost Boys, where it's like, you know, an angsty lost teen that, you know, wants to be a part of something more than just the typical, you know, day to day life kind of thing.
That and saxophone music.
That is not correct.
That's sexy sex.
This might be a good time to talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer as this, again, another sort of seismic shift in vampire paradigms, where suddenly, like, the young, fresh, powerful force is the slayer rather than the vampire. I mean, obviously, like, there's a lot of sort of gender empowerment that goes into that that character, but I do think it's interesting to see, you know, played for comedy, but not always, the ways that this ingenue, essentially, like this sort of classic vampire victim, confronts the vampires who are so secure in their superiority and just like routinely destroys them. So that was like a major.
Plus the movie brought Paul Reubens Buffy the Vampire.
He has Pee Wee Herman as the Vampire King. That's right. Lest we forget.
And well, what year did Buffy the Vampire Slayer start? Because I'm thinking of like Blade. Blade also had that idea of being very much in that vampire universe, but having the main character be the slayer rather than the vampire, I suppose. And
so in the Marvel universe, we had Morbius the Vampire too, who was a doctor that turned himself into a vampire and was like the good vampire. And same with like Blade, who's, you know, a half vampire hunter.
Yeah, Morbius is like the tortured poet or something, character yeah. like that.
Yeah, he's like the vampire version of Beast. He's like super smart and like more cultured than his alter ego lets on, like his alter ego persona.
Yeah, but that seems like that's more like a retelling of the old vampire stories rather than Buffy, who's basically, that's a teenage like story. That's and a teenager rebelling against the oldest people in the room, like the boomers.
I love that.
That's what she is. She's just like, I'm a empowered teenager, and I can do whatever I fucking want, and you can't stop me.
So I saw that in the movie, and truth be told, I never watched the TV series. Hate me, don't at me, whatever. But like, yeah, it's a passing of the torch to this, especially to the, you know, Valley girl. Like, that's how she's portrayed in the movie. Kind of like this stereotypical ditzy blonde that really, you know, empowers herself and faces off against, you know, the bad guys. And in the end, spoiler alert, wins.
Yeah, Buffy was like massively influential for my generation. Like, but I mean, it was one of the, and, you know, I mean, everybody says this all the time, and we have since learned that Joss Whedon is a piece of flaming garbage, but it was.
So is the original actress. Kristen, what's her name?
Yeah. Was it Christine Applegate? Was she? No.
No, it's like not Kristen Stewart. Anyway, going ahead.
No, Kristen Bell? No. No, no. Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember who was in the movie. Yeah, but no, like, I'm talking about the TV show. Like, I don't know. There was just something about it, because she was, like, so cool, but also, like, it didn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, because she was better than that. I don't know. It was a big, you know, sort of central moment for a lot of us when that came out.
Yeah. So that's the TV series also did something different. Like, the movie, original movie, was basically just, yeah, a teenager is powerful enough to stand against any adult in the room, basically. But in the TV series, it also became a lot about being the person on the outside, the freak, so to say, and them being the most powerful people. They're empowering us, the nerds, also. So I specifically, it resonated a lot with me as well, being a nerd. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the movie, it was like she had to take off this mantle of popularity to go hang it with, like, you know, Luke Perry, who was kind of like, you know, the greaser, loser kind of guy, and do things that wasn't part of her clique, and I don't know.
Yeah, but it was still, like, the main thing that, like, empowered her was not, she was not powerful, like, despite of her popularity. She kind of embraced all of her in the end to become more powerful. I mean, yeah. There's a different difference in what story they're telling in the movie versus the TV series, and it ends up being a lot more like a general coming of age in the, like, more nuanced coming in age of in the TV series, in my opinion, at least.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there were some episodes that kind of felt like, you know, on a very special episode. Like, there was one about, like, drinking on campus where they all went to college and, like, turned in cave people because they had too much beer. Like, you know, I mean, there were ones like that where it was kind of like, oh, that was a little bit
turned into cave people.
But, like, yeah, overall, I mean, the kind of...
I thought you said cave people. Gay people or cave people?
Cave.
Like Neanderthals?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
Like booga booga.
It's like it was like a parable for like what beer does to you if you drink. Yeah, I don't know. That was one of the episodes I remember being like, really, you guys? But I mean, there were like just like gut wrenching kind of confrontations with what would be like, you know, sort of external threats like the vampires, but then also the kind of internal buildings Roman, like where the, you know, the coming of age or like the, you know, these are the things that you have to confront within yourself if you're going to grow as a person, in addition to, you know, managing the kind of external pressures of the world.
That's interesting. What would you say that the genre of Buffy the Vampire Slayer is?
Teenage hack.
The sci-fi, I guess. Like horror sci-fi.
Is it horror, though?
Like, I would say young.
There's definitely some episodes that are absolute horror.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen Buffy, so I can't speak on its genre, but it sounds to me like it's in that like same Teen Wolf and like True Blood,
or
not True Blood, Vampire Diaries, sorry, like not Supernatural, where it's like about high schoolers, but there's also just like doing high school things, but then also there just happen to be monsters, and like it's really just like a high school show, but also sometimes they fight monsters.
I think that's how it Monster started. Sword. I think as it evolved, like, I don't know. I mean, I clearly have like this very, you know, sort of personal relationship with the show, because like I was basically, you know, not to like out myself here, but I was basically like the same age as the people. So watching them, you know, maybe like a year or two ahead of me, like watching them kind of go through these, like, okay, this is high school, and then we go to college, and then we have like adult relationships. Like, it was a very long arc in terms of like maturation and you know, sort of learning how to be like a functional human. But they confronted, you know, all kinds of like, her, you know, her mom passes away, and like, you know, her best friend is gay, and they have to kind of like come to terms with what that means in a time that like people weren't really represented, you know, all that well or at all in mainstream media. And, you know, I don't know, it was just there was a lot there that was, I think, really important for the people that were seeing it. So I do agree that it began as like a kind of high school monster of the week thing, but then like the longer it progressed and the older the characters got, like the show really grew along with them in some pretty impressive ways. So
yeah, if I have to label it, I would call it a young adult horror rom-com Yeah, it does all those things at separate occasions, and sometimes all at once.
Yeah, like, it definitely sounds like it's like a, if you took the original first couple seasons of Degrassi, The Next Generation, and just also added in like vampires and stuff, where it's like you have these people and you see them grow and like evolve as people and deal with like teenage issues, but then also sometimes they fight monsters.
Yeah, that's something I kind of wanted to talk about, the sort of genre that vampires appear in. Like, I suppose, would we say that they began in the horror genre of Dracula and all that stuff? But I feel like recently they show up in a lot of like romance and just like general fantasy adventure as well, just as like just another kind of monster for the heroes to slay in a lot of ways as well, and as main characters as well in like rom-coms and just like sci-fi young adult stuff. And
I mean, I feel like, the again, you know, sort of distinguishing it from the plebeian like basic vampire, like if we're talking about the aristocratic like suave kind of seductive vampire, I think that there's always been an element, even in Dracula, of like titillation is such an awful word, but I mean, I really feel like, I don't think they've ever been like
beguiling or something.
Yeah, like that there's always been like an eroticism to them that transcends a portion of the horror genre. So like maybe fantasy is a better, like including kind of like erotic.
I posted in the chat that the link to like the Jewish vampires that I'd learned were a thing, and they're all about like sex and stuff, and that was in the, you know, like when the rabbis were writing in like 1200. So there's always been this like sexy thing, but I think actually more recently there's been more of a like common out, like an everyday Joe vampire, like sometimes like the vampire's just, you know, living his life and whatever, and there's nothing they've vampires have kind of like evolved past just being about sex and like horror, I think. Like they've become, I don't know, I'm just thinking of like Adventure Time right now because that's the first thing that popped into my head, but there's like a vampire character in that show and she just like is like plays guitar and is like whatever and sometimes turns really scary, but it's like
Marcelly and the Vampire Queen.
Yeah. And like obviously that's a kids show so they're not going to have anything like super sexual in it, but it is like this diversion because like even I was thinking I didn't realize these characters weren't actually vampires, but in Scooby-Doo there's like a in the 90s
it's always a guy in a mask. Abby,
no, the Hex Girls, which I thought they were vampires, apparently they're witches, but one of them has pointy teeth so I can say she's a vampire. Like they're very sexual and stuff, and like that's still like a, you know, kids media and stuff, but like you start to get these divergent things with like that vampires can just kind of like exist and be their own thing. Like same with I haven't seen the show version, but like What We Do in the Shadows, you know, they're just guys living in a house, you know.
Watch the show, it's so good.
It is so good, yeah.
But it's weird that you could that they're portrayed like sometimes as solitary like predators, and it seems like the more solitary they are, the more darker and predatorial they are. But like if they got like a group of vampires around, they're kind of like a fun bunch of, you know, vampires.
Yes, sometimes they're moralized or demoralized because of their group. They keep each other in check or out of check, so to say. It's either one or the other, I think. That's why my experience, at least, when they're groups of vampires.
Yeah. Yeah, there's often Game Louis of Thrones type power struggles.
Oh yeah.
In vampire societies.
What's a vamp? Is it a nest? Is that like the official?
A collective node.
I thought it was like a coven, like a witch coven.
It's a coterie.
A coterie? What is that?
It's a congress.
It's a vampire coterie.
It's a murder.
Are you serious? Murder.
At least in Vampire the Masquerade, they call it a coterie.
All of those terminologies for groups of animals were just made up by these two guys having a good time, so it can be whatever the fuck it wants to be, okay?
What, really? Which two guys were those?
I don't remember, but these two, like, aristocrat guys were like, we should just make a book of, like, names for groups of animals, and they literally just did, and then everyone just kind of was like, okay, this is accepted
this
now.
This is gospel now.
They were the first.
I'll say, too, if stories like Conan or A Song of Ice and Fire are like sex and swordplay, stories on vampires are pretty much just sex and blood.
That kind of other meaning of fantasy in there, I suppose.
Tits and fangs.
Sign me up. Anyway, did anyone want to talk about Elizabeth Bathory some more?
Abby, isn't this your girl?
I mean, I don't know. I just, like, I'm really fascinated by, like, this is really going to make me sound like a serial killer, but I really like all the, like, super, like, stories of, like, cannibalism and, like, people just being the, like, disgustingest humans possible in terms of, like, doing things with other humans that aren't sex, because that's gross. But, like, I don't know.
That's why we're all here.
That's gross.
Well, like, that's, like, that takes a step too far for me. I'm, like, I don't want to hear about, like, all the, like, gross, like, non-consensual things that this person, you know, is in partaking in that terms. But, like, I don't know. I just remember when this was what kind of, I wouldn't say got me into vampires because I never really had, like, a real interest in them. But, like, I was definitely more intrigued when I was, like, in middle school and I learned about Elizabeth Bathory. And I was, like, this is, like, the shit. Like, I need to know every instance in history ever where something like this happened because it's cool as fuck. So I don't know. I just think that these stories are really interesting when you have like an application of something that is so obviously like not real, but someone is like doing something in real, like something, a historical record of this thing that actually occurred. And like obviously her bathing in the blood of young girls didn't, you know, give her immortality or like make her skin look more, make her look youthful or whatever. But it's just really fascinating that like the things that these people can do that they think will give them these like powers and stuff, and I just think it's really interesting.
Just for the listener, can we have like the cliff notes of who Elizabeth Bathory was and when she lived and where?
Okay, I can't give you an exact date, but I want to say she was 1600s or 1700s in Hungary, and she was like a noble woman, And basically, she just had a bunch of, like, she believed that if she bathed in the blood of young girls, like, she would stay beautiful forever. Like, it would, like, rejuvenate her skin or whatever. So she would just have, like, a bunch of servant girls and, like, bleed them. And then eventually, when people kind of realized what was going on, she got locked in, like, a tower and, like, starved to death. It was pretty cool.
What Abby left out was she was able to do this for, like, 200 to 300 peasant girls, but then she started having other nobility, young women from the nobility class over and bled them, and that's when she was caught. And for her digression, she got house arrest.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before, where, like, as long as it was just, quote-unquote, just peasants that were going missing, nobody really looked into it. And that was also the case with Gilles de Rais, where he started fostering, like, higher social classes, and, like, those kids started disappearing, and then people started asking questions. So yeah, it's exactly, like, it's a definitely, like, a major privileged aristocracy question as well.
It is also really interesting because she's Hungarian, but, like, the area, this was, like, back when also, like, Hungary was the big, whatever the word is, empire, I guess. I don't think it was, like, an empire, but you know what I mean, like, a big kingdom. And so this was also, like, part of, like, Romania and stuff. And so then you can kind of, I thought it was interesting, you know, with the whole, like, because vampires are always associated now with Romania, obviously. So it is interesting.
Transylvania.
Yeah, that this thing occurred in, yeah, in this, a similar, like, culture and, like, geographical region. So, yeah.
In your research into this, you said that you tried to find other examples of people, like, bathing in blood and trying to, like, rejuvenate themselves or steal others' life force. Did you find any examples from history, any other ones?
This was a long time ago. Like, this had to have been, like, almost 10 years ago when I was really interested in all of this stuff. And all I can think of is, like, but this is, it's more not for, like, to steal a life force, but just because these people are crazy. Like, I just think of in Chicago, there were, like, two instances of murder hotels where people, I was fascinated with the, like,
H.H. Holmes.
Yeah. You know, the World's Fair and everything, and just how these people can get away with this, like, you know, these mass serial killings, I guess.
So to Peter, like, what you said, made me think of blood magic, and there's a lot of that in, like, the sacred groves of the Celts and the Druids and stuff like that, but also in like Aztec and Mayan and Olmec and Toltec and Incan religion, like, there's blood sacrifice required for the gods of the sun and rain and stuff like that that would need to be performed.
I think the Romans as well did a lot of, like, sacrificing oxen and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just meant for, like, human-wise.
A human sacrifice.
Yeah, like, a lot of cultures, like, especially Scandinavian cultures, would, or the Vikings, maybe you guys could speak to it, would sacrifice bulls or their horses before battle to, you know, win the favor of the gods.
There were sacrifices. I don't know what, who you say we, if
Peter you northern people, you Northmen.
Oh, well, I'm just saying Peter has repeatedly said that he's not part of Scandinavia necessarily. So in that sense,
not on the peninsula.
Okay, well, in any case, yeah, there were sacrifices. There's even been sacrifices of thralls as well, for specific purposes, and usually just because thralls were you know, property as much as anything else. So it's, I'm not sure whether or not I can attest to or at least confirm that it was a power thing necessarily always. It was probably usually also just, you know, afterwards you would sacrifice things because you would give him something with, you know, a vestige of their power, so to say, how much they accomplished in life.
Can you speak to whether the idea about like, if a Viking chieftain or king died, they would, like, send a few wives with him when he died, like in the funeral boat or whatever?
Well, I've heard of graves where the wife or at least a female has been buried with it. Whether or not you know, there's no actual definitive answer on that necessarily, whether it's a tradition or anything. So I can't speak to that specifically.
So it might be
there was a
pop culture legend.
Yeah,
well, there's a manuscript by an Arab traveler that recounts a Rus funeral like that, where they did have a sacrifice, like a live slave or wife or something attached to the boat that was burning. But I think like that's the only written account.
Oh, is that the one that the Antonio Banderas movie is based on, the 13th
Warrior? Yeah, exactly. Ibn Taban is the traveler.
And that's over dramatized, of course. A lot of things have been
just debunked. Slightly.
A lot of those things have been debunked afterwards. So, take it with a grain of salt. But we know that thralls have been buried with their chieftain or their owner, at least. So much I can confirm.
Yeah, I know for a fact that did happen in. I'm going to sound really bad because I can't remember which Mesoamerican culture it was, but one of them, they would bury the like servants and stuff with the dead person.
And pharaohs as well. And is the China, the terracotta army, well. Like were there bodies of servants in the tomb where the terracotta army is, or is it just the statues?
Okay, well why are we not talking about Vlad Tepes?
Please take us away with old lad.
Oh, I'm just saying that since we've basically gone through the literature about Dracula, we should also go through the historical legend about him. And as far as I know, and I've looked into it a bit, yeah, his father was Dracul, At the time, they were sort of attacking, or at least they were in conflict with the Ottoman Empire, as far as I remember. And then the brother of little Vlad was taken hostage, didn't really mind it that much, apparently. But they wanted to sort of, the Ottoman Empire wanted to get hold of the area where the ancestral home of Vladimir Tepes. And then he sort of said, well, no, and you're not going to get it, and I'm going to scorch the earth, basically. So he took a lot of the nobles and everything and put and staked them, basically, on pikes all the way on the road that the Ottomans were to pass through if they wanted to get to his area. And in general, the Transylvania area, the area where he came from, was sort of the way the Ottomans would get into Europe proper if they wanted to. So he was sort of the first vanguard, first area of defense from everything. So basically, yeah, he gets the story from the idea that he impaled like 100 people on pikes.
Just like unimaginable cruelty.
There's that woodcutting of him like dining while, you know, in front of all his impaled victims too.
Mm. Oh yeah.
I think that like there's more, like he was, because you're right, like he's right on the border of like the Ottoman Empire and Transylvania, but I think he was taken captive as like either a ward or as a prisoner of war by like one of the Sultan's Mehmed or something like that. And held by the Ottomans for a while during his youth, and he kind of held that against them, and that's why he went super cruel at the end.
But his brother was also in league with the Ottomans, as far as I remember.
Yeah, it's actually his own countrymen that eventually killed him because they're just sick of his shit.
Yeah, so he was crazy, of course. But the whole Dracula basically just means a little dragon or little... little dragon or little demon, because whatever, I can't remember the name of the specific language stem there. Dragon and demon is sort of like the same thing, basically. So dragon, and it was sort of like derogatory to begin with.
I thought it was dragon because it was more like a religious sect.
Yeah, like, his father was part of the Order of the Dragon, but it could also, but the there was a double meaning in the word Dracul.
See, and I thought the order was more like a, not necessarily a cult, but like some sort of military or aristo group.
Yeah, like the Templar Knights or the Knights Hospitallier, whatever that French word is, or like the Teutonic Knights.
And I think you're right. I think just that he was crazy. I think that mainly the even though his father was like a knight or the head knight of the Ordo Dracul, as it was called, he was certainly not that sort of material necessarily.
And is there a direct connection between Bram Stoker's writings and this historical Vlad Tepes?
I think there is, just because he heard the story and kind of was like, hey, that's a good Dracula. Perfect. Got it.
And all those stories and depictions, or the histories you recounted there, really reminded me of the Boltons in A Song of Ice and Fire. And I think it's fair to say that George R. R. Martin uses a lot of that sort of Dracula and vampire imagery in describing the Boltons and their general vibe, I suppose.
The Boltons are not vampires. I know that's a theory somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think they're actual
vampires.
I mean,
if anything, vampires, they're zombies.
They're homunculi.
But even the armor that runs the... Sorry, you were agreeing with me, Xander. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I do agree. Martin is definitely kind of drawing off that Bram Stoker, Vlad the Impaler idea for the Boltons.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
are you drawing on that idea for most of Westeros?
Yeah, especially like when Daenerys stakes every one of the slave owners.
Oh, yeah.
I thought she crucified him.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah, and I think the armor that Ramsay wears, it's like a flayed man, and it's painted red. I think that's a direct reference to the armor from the
Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stoker's Dracula from the 90s.
So
that's
cool.
What I always pictured, too.
Such a good movie.
Yeah, me too.
And Winona Ryder is so pretty.
Yeah, she had young Varley feelings.
Yeah, that's a good movie. I should probably rewatch that. I watched the one with Bard the Bowman that came out recently, and that was just...
That is not a good movie.
That was just shit. Just other shit. I mean, I guess it had Charles Dance in it, and he made for a pretty cool vampire, but that was the only good scene in the movie.
Yeah, I made it, I think, maybe half an hour into that movie. I was just like, I can't do it.
Simply can't. So we talked a little bit about Buffy earlier, but what are you guys' like favorite vampire stories in general? Would you like to tell us about one that you particularly like?
I read some of the novels for the role playing game Vampire the Masquerade, and there's this story, this trilogy of novels. Where it's basically this former slave made vampire, and he becomes like sort of like a policeman within the vampire society, and he unravels
what
this
era. Was he born in? You said a former slave, so
yeah. So he was born in like this. I think it was under the Underground Railroad sort of time.
Okay.
And then he basically got turned and killed everyone in his former plantation. And then and the story jumps then like 150 years or something like that, or something like that. And then we see him again with a lot of power. So suddenly he's like the sheriff or something above a sheriff sort of in the thing. In the society, vampire society.
Is he in the Camarilla, the sort of vampire society?
Yeah, the Camarilla. Camarilla is like the order and rule based society in the vampire world, in the Vampire of the Masquerade. So he's like the one who's keeping order. He's like directly under, like the third in line to
maintaining the masquerade, so that the vampires don't reveal themselves to the Muggles.
Exactly. That's the premise, but the whole story revolves around this slave ring that the vampires have set up to sort of ferry around suitable blood vessels so that they can, you know, have interesting palatal experiences. And well, that's not great, he thinks, because he doesn't like slavery for good reasons. And he it's just a very good story about him fighting the beast within. He in the that world, they always are fighting the inner demons of themselves, trying to keep control and keep their humanity. And he's especially prone to let himself go into frenzy. So he's fighting himself, trying to fight the shackles of society, and is basically instrumental in unraveling a giant demonic worshipping slave ring in through the course of three books.
No, that sounds cool. Like the video game, Vampire: The Masquerade Bloodlines is one of my favorite pieces of vampire fiction, definitely. So I'm kind of looked into that World of Darkness vampire lore on like wikis and stuff. So I'm into that. What family of vampires is the main character you were talking about from in that story?
He's a Bruja.
So the sort of anarchist,
fighter,
fighter of vampires.
Yeah, former philosopher kings, now just rabble, people call them. But this guy, he has a very strong philosophy about freedom and letting people choose where their direction in life or on life should be. So, yeah, if you like to know more about it, it's a book trilogy about Theobel. Look that up. That's a good story.
Theobel. Okay.
Yeah.
I got to say my favorite are Anne Rice's Vampires. Interview with the Vampire was one of my favorite books that I read, I don't know, maybe 7th or 8th grade. And I did a monologue from that book for my audition into the Thespian Society in high school.
I'm so happy that's on here now.
Can you still do it?
Oh my God, that was like 1997, man. No, I
can't. So yes, but he doesn't want to.
No, I cannot still do it. But it was him recounting.
What scene was it from?
It was him recounting his revenge on the Theater of Ice Vampires because they killed Claudia and
that's a good one.
Yeah.
I also we talked about the movie, but I really love the movie as well. Just not because of its how true it is or not true it is to the book. But just some of the people they got into playing the characters are phenomenal. Like a lot of teenage fantasies based around that.
It's kind of amazing the cast they had when you look at it in hindsight.
Yeah.
But I agree with Varley. Most of my vampire love comes from the Anne Rice novels. They get kind of hard after Queen of the Damned. But I really love the...
What do you mean by they get hard?
Erection.
I was being serious, guys.
They don't have flowing blood. They can't.
Like, I've tried to read. I've started and stopped reading the Tale of the Body Thief many times.
Tale of Body Thief, yeah. Dude, it's just... Oh, man, it's so hard to read. But yeah, and then also the we already mentioned the 90s Bram Stoker's Dracula movie. But I also, because I'm a huge cinephile, I also love Nosferatu. I think that's one of the coolest adaptions of Dracula specifically, but also a neat retelling of a vampire tale.
Also like the first ever horror movie, right?
Yeah. It was, I don't remember if it was during or right before the German impressionist films, which are some of the most beautifully shot films, you know.
I read a book called The Lord of the Dead, and it's by Tom Holland, but I don't think it's that Tom Holland. It's basically like the quote-unquote true story of Lord Byron and like how he actually became a vampire. So it's like historical fiction, but after reading it, it's so compellingly interwoven with Byron's actual poetry that it's like really hard for me not to think of Byron as just a vampire.
Is that your headcanon now?
It is my headcanon. Yeah, it's such a it was really, really well done because it's like interlaced with his actual trips to the European continent and the poems that he wrote like in concurrence with those journeys, but like woven into this narrative of how he actually encountered like vampires in Greece and was turned into one. And when you read his poem, like his actual poems alongside this crafted narrative, they become like very entangled in ways that I just remember. I mean, I read it a really long time ago, so like I can't, you know, I could read it again and think it's crap, but like I remember being so impressed by it, like how well everything fit together and like how well the author like really built on Byron's actual experiences but made it this like convincing kind of backstory like underneath it with the so highly recommended.
And sort of building it on historical infrastructure sounds like a very cool idea.
Yeah, that's so
well,
cool.
Especially because Byron was probably the inspiration for Lord Ruthven, who was like the original, like Polidori's vampire, came out of that same trip to the country house that inspired
Polidori's vampire, did you say?
Yeah, so the Polidori, John Polidori was the doctor that was with Shelley and Byron and Mary Shelley at their like Geneva retreat or whatever, and they had the horror storytelling contest, and that's what inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein.
That's right.
Yeah, like the same storytelling, you know, round table or whatever that they had also inspired John Polidori to write The Vampire, which is like the precursor to a lot of the ideas that appear in Bram Stoker's Dracula, but it like so the aristocratic, very like cool, you know, kind of appealing but dark like vampire trope came actually from Polidori's vampire. And the argument is, or the contention is, that like because he was on that trip and because he was intimately acquainted with Byron, that like Byron's, you know, sort of proclivities were actually one of the major inspirations for this aristocratic fancy vampire.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. I like the idea of a semi-historical vampire story. I sort of enjoy crypto history as well. Like the story is the lore behind Vampire the Masquerade, the where Lilith is sort of like the first wife of Adam and still fixes into every part of the lore in all the in all the bits. I am a Christian. That's basically the same sort of thing where I make it my headcanon that she is sort of out there and God somehow, you know, made a mistake, but somewhere made her, and then, you know, now we'll redo that. We'll do Eve then afterwards. So that's fun. So how about powers? Should we go into some of the cool powers?
Sure, we can go into like vampire powers and what those are or should be in your mind. Yes, that is the thing where we have our thoughts, the mind. Yes.
Sometimes.
Okay, so what sort of vampire powers are there?
So there's like and I don't know if this is just because like mesmerism was just kind of developing in the late 1800s, but Dracula seems to be able to mesmerize people with his eyes. And I think that's a common trope of kind of like this hypno state that like predators can put their prey into that just allows them to succumb to whatever comes next.
Yeah, that's, and that's the idea of fight, flight, or freeze. So I guess it's that like freeze, or maybe it's different from that, I suppose, as well, since it's kind of like they're willing victims oftentimes, that the vampire sort of beguiles them into giving themselves over in a way, I suppose. And that's very sexual as well, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's also the thing that it's more like you're the natural prey of that being, that so it's sort of hard-coded into your DNA that you have to, like, you can't really fight it. That's also a trope within it.
Yeah, like sometimes I've heard that prey animals like rabbits, like when they're caught by a predator, they will fight for a certain amount of time, but then they will just sort of give in to it and go limp. And like, even if they had the like capability to still fight back, they don't. And they just sort of like give themselves over to the experience of being eaten, I suppose.
Side note, like, typically the only sound a rabbit will ever make is right before it dies, when it's in, like, the talons of something or in the jaws of something.
Yeah, and then he screams.
Dude, the
right?
Death screams yep. are worse. Aww.
Let's move on.
Yeah, but we can still talk about that sort of hypnosis or beguiling power a little bit, because I sort of associate that with the sirens from Greek myth, who are like these mermaids who mesmerize sailors or lure sailors into their doom with their beautiful song. Or like there are often these temptresses who are like beautiful women, or maybe monsters that are making themselves appear like beautiful women, that are sort of like luring people into their doom. And you get that with witches a lot as well.
Yeah, Uldra as well in Northern mythology. They could be either witches or something like more like a fae creature that would dance around swamps and whatever, and lure men into the swamps so they would die.
That's Uldra?
Huldra, like Huldra. Yeah, like Huldra, I think would be the general pronunciation.
Or that's what happens when men don't think with their brains.
Yep. But then again, it's still something
that's
a primeval thing where like a early where the woman is the dangerous, powerful one. Again.
With the sirens specifically, especially in the Odyssey, Jean-Pierre Vernant has argued that they are an embodiment of the temptation to know your afterlife before you die, which is an impossibility for mortals. But the idea is that if you listen to their song, you get a sense of, or you're sort of drawn in by the sense of like knowing how you'll be remembered after you die. And so there's that sense of like forbidden knowledge and sort of knowledge beyond human ability. But then there's also that lure of, you know, knowledge beyond the grave specifically. Right. So you can almost like beat death by running towards it, and almost like through it kind of, which is obviously impossible for mortal creatures, but that's the particular appeal of the sirens. Is that there's that possibility. So I wonder too, if like,
I never knew that. I just thought it was like just like a pretty lady singing to you from a rock somewhere.
I think that's probably also like, we've been at sea for a long time, boys, let's go over there. And you know, but like if you're looking at it on a more, you know, sort of metaphysical level, like there's that element to the way that they're presented, again, especially in the Odyssey, because there's a lot about like how a song is kind of the only vehicle for immortality, but you can't have access to your own song. You can only it can only be sung of you like after you're gone. But also, you know, the fishy strange, I guess, is pretty appealing if you've been at sea for a long time. So, you know. We got high low.
I don't like that you said fishy strange.
Okay, I will thank
say,
you for that.
We become overly intellectual. just throw that in.
I will say that's super interesting because I've never, I guess, made the connection of like kind of like sirens songs and like the mortality part with vampires, because I guess I kind of just always assumed like their power was just, oh, I'm super charming, look at how charming I am, kind of thing, rather than a more, I don't know, less lame thing.
Yeah, it's definitely something about legacy, like mm-hmm. in both areas, but vampires are like the escape from the end, and being able to have, you know, unlimited time to create your legacy in a way. The fear of death, which most of us know very well, is also like the whole fear of not having a legacy at the end when the chapter closes on you.
So it's fun. All a big nothing. Yeah, definitely that immortality is often a theme or power of vampires that is explored to great length in vampire fiction. And also one of those fantasies that a lot of us probably have of, or have entertained at some time, of like being immortal and having all the time in the world to do all the things that we want to.
yeah, I think it's that fascination of almost like forming a relationship with death, right? So that like if you succumb to the vampire, if you approach the vampire, you're approaching something that is otherwise unapproachable or imperceptible or completely abstract, and then suddenly you have this very frightening but yet also like very alluring kind of personification of that mystery.
Right. You rather than you become death, death becomes you, sort of idea.
You gain power over death, at least. And that also ties into the whole idea of vampires also being tied to necromancy, like having maybe ability to raise other dead as a part of their abilities. Like in Draugr, the Nordish sort of vampires, they were like ancestors that would come back to exact revenge on someone, but they could also, you know, raise the dead to fight for them as well. So
that's true. Also kind of reminds me of that we have these two themes of necromancy and raising the dead with the others in A Song of Ice and Fire as well. And while they are not vampires, they do have many features in common with vampires of being like immortal beings. That I think there's some references of them like leeching blood or vitality from their victims as well. And like, I think there's a lot of sort of fairy stuff in there as well that George puts in there, but yeah, there's like, they are kind of ice vampire demons in some ways.
Yeah, there's a Native American Wendigo whose heart is made of ice.
Oh, yeah.
The Wendigo's so scary. I love
the Wendigo.
Yeah.
That the also Wendigo took is long the, enough.
Yeah, the embodiment of starvation cannibalism. Right.
It's someone who committed cannibalism and then lives on afterwards and kind of eats people.
Yeah. I am here for that.
The discussion, not the...
Yeah, I really like the like cannibalism tie-ins, and like often vampires, aside from having like reanimated corpses as their servants through necromancy in a lot of fantasy settings, they also command ghouls, which are like not quite undead, but are often like degenerate human beings who have descended into cannibalism and are like very bestial and feral and kind of like usually these like pale, gangrel, lanky creatures. And I really like those kinds of ghoulish creatures.
Yeah.
So it occurred to me, thinking about the Draugr, which is, Patrick, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't they usually fairly mindless, like more like a zombie than a...
It's close to a zombie, yeah, but no, well, depends. They're more like whites, so to say. So they might have a spirit or like a ghost-like singular purpose. So in that sense, zombies are intrinsically mindless, and therefore they're different, at least.
So they have a motivation, at least.
They have a motivation. Sometimes they can also plan and negotiate towards their one purpose. So they're just single-minded.
Sort of a revenant sometimes.
My question is, and I guess this might be going back to like the discussion at the very beginning, but are there depictions of vampires that are like not humanoid? Because I think that in my brain, like a vampire, one thing with vampires is like they can hide in plain sight, and that's what's like adds to like the mythology of making them so scary, is like you don't know who a vampire is really. And so that's kind of what separates like a vampire from, say, not like a zombie, because in my brain, like zombies are usually not in control of their actions really, but like from another life-leeching another
sort of creature. Undead creature, like yeah, a witch, like are there something.
Yeah, because I would assume most in my brain, like vampires always look human, like they might maybe have like pointy ears or, you know, something like a little they different.
They infiltrate human societies as well. That's a fun part of the story as well, usually. Like, then you get the witch hunters and inquisitors to hunt them down, and that's cool as well. But yeah, about the non-human thing, I feel like often vampires will have this more sort of monstrous form that might look more like a man-bat or something like that, where they sort of like Yeah, well, take on a more bestial appearance with like maybe a bat's face and wings and very monstrous.
That's more like their like true form, and they can like usually like I don't know how to explain this. Like I just think of it more as like man bat. Sorry. No, you continue with what you're saying. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, I think I was done, but are you talking about non-humanoid vampires? Like even Man-Bat is kind of humanoid, so if there was like, I suppose in some stories you get like aliens that are kind of like parasitic leeches or something that takes you over or something like that. That's like the Goa'uld in Stargate or something like that, that kind of is maybe a bit similar, or like a virus or a disease that is the vampire, but... Like, I don't think there are any stories that where, like, vampires are cats or dogs or something like that.
Yeah, like, I guess I'm just thinking of it as, like, the, so, I forget who it was that was just talking that compared, like, the White Walkers or whatever the, I feel like that's the show term for it, honestly, it's been so long. The, like, the whites and stuff to vampires and, like, see, in my brain, like, those are more like zombies. Like, you get, like, that's just, I don't know, like, vampires to me are, like, very... Very well, human.
I think we were talking earlier about them being mindless, and I think the others, or the White Walkers from A Song of Ice and Fire, they're like a, I feel like they're people, sort of like a different race of beings, that they're not like the mindless servants of some other power that are dancing on strings like puppets, like zombies are typically depicted as.
Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know, but like, so like in my brain, like they're not similar to vampires at all, but like everyone has their own opinion, but like just, I wouldn't know what they are, but like.
Well, they're elemental, so, yes, which is a different, yeah.
It sort of puts in, it goes into the thing where it's said that you probably should differentiate between the modern vampire and the more pre-modern, pre-Victorian vampires, because in that sense, you would have more like those, you know, returned relatives or people who are basically the evil part of themselves returning and preying upon family or the community or something like that. And that's still a, like, I would say that was still a vampire, just not a modern vampire necessarily.
So it strikes me in thinking about all of this that one of the major distinctions between vampires and other kind of revenants, I guess maybe we could use as a category, is their autonomy. Like they continue to live lives that are largely undifferentiated from their lives before they were born, except potentially like enhanced, right? Whereas like a zombie or a, you know, necromanced corpse, or, you know, these much more sort of single-minded creatures. And I agree that the sort of earlier folkloric vampires feel more more in that category, but even the Strigae or the Lamia or whatever, like they're creatures who have their own like rich internal life, I guess is maybe
well, that's maybe probably like
living the best life.
Right, exactly that. Like, their best unlife, I guess. You know, like there's an afterlife. There's a promise of an afterlife, of a complete afterlife, I guess.
I agree. Much yeah. More
so than well, that's why I think they're so them vampires and like werewolves are so popular in like modern, like very modern fiction, not just like, you know, like if we're counting modern as Dracula, but like in the 21st century fiction, is because you can have this like duality of, we can relate to them because they can do normal human things, but then also they either have this like curse or this different thing that makes us fascinated by them.
Curse.
But
they're it's a gift.
Well, I was talking about also like werewolves and stuff, but it's like very the stories that like we can get from vampires and werewolves and like other like supernatural creatures that are still able to like retain some humanity are much more fascinating to us because we can live through them, I guess. Whereas like, I mean, there are stories about zombies. Like I'm thinking of, there's like some TV show that's really popular, like iZombie or whatever, but like it's not in line with like the traditional zombie. It's like, it's yeah. Where they're, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of truth to what you're saying, that we can sort of like identify with these monsters? I suppose vampires and werewolves are two of the big examples of monsters that were once human, and we can sort of maybe explore our own monstrous side through them in a way.
Yeah, and they're both like, one of them is like the depravity of humans, and the other one is more like the feralness, the pure animalistic instincts. And both are forces within ourselves, and if we're going to go to the romance period, that's basically what they're saying, that the nature is stronger than humans, that we should take inspiration from nature rather than anything else, because that's where the true poesy and true power comes from.
So I would argue, yeah, that there's a sort of inhumanity to certain creatures, like the undead, and then there's like a superhumanity to werewolves and vampires. And I would suggest that appeal goes as far back as like Proto-Indo-European mythology, where the most venerated heroes aren't moral, they're just extra, right? That Achilles
the ones that have sex with the horses.
What? Those were not the ones I had in mind.
Well, you said Proto-Indo-European, so I thought we were talking about how like the way the king was like passed down was like, I can't remember the exact mythos, but it's like there's an interpretation differentiation where if they're like actually having sex with the horse or if they're just like watching the horses have sex. But this was like a big Proto-Indo-European mythos that they believe.
That's
like
a pretty
spread.
Big distinction.
Well, no, that's the thing. Yeah, that's part of it. That's the part of it. Is like we don't really have like the exact translation, and so there's two schools of thought. But yeah.
So
this is not. Yeah, that was no. What I was thinking, maybe proto. We can just sort of drop the proto. But I think it's. I think it's rooted in Proto-Indo-European. But this idea that to be exceptional or to be divine or semi-divine, you're not exceptionally moral, and you're not even necessarily exceptionally good. you're extra human, right? You're superhuman. So the way that superhumanity manifests itself in metaphor and then also behaviorally and in terms of achievement in these, you know, the Aristoi of the Homeric heroes, for example, are the moments at which they are the most heroic and the most excellent and the most superhuman, but they are also described explicitly as being the most bestial at that point, right? So they're predatory lions, or they're wolves glutting themselves. So the closer that they get to divinity or superhumanity, the closer they are also to animality. And I think that, you know, the sort of adding on of these extra superhuman characteristics without losing any of that underlying humanness, and I don't mean humanity in the sense of like fellow feeling and, you know, love for your man, but like just the humanity, and then there's like a bunch of other stuff like layered on top of it that makes you that much more dangerous and that much more overwhelming.
But that's a power mythos in general, like if whether or not you're a demon or a vampire or anything, or a hero, you're basically so powerful that like morality does not apply to you in a sense. The gods in Greek mythology and Norse mythology are not good gods. They're just powerful. So, yeah. So I think that's, and if you talk about Lilith or something, that might be a progenitor to the vampire mythos as we know it today. I don't think that necessarily counts into the differentiation about what vampires were necessarily. I think that's just comes with the idea of vampires being so powerful that they sort of transcends morality at some point.
Yeah, or they have the option to be immoral or amoral and not care about human sort of ideas of morality at all. So it's kind of the truest test of character is like when you have no chains on you, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the closest, at least in you know, sort of Greco-Roman structures, like the closest that you can get to divinity, or the closer you get to divinity, the sort of most defining characteristic of that, aside from immortality, is freedom from consequences. So whenever the gods participate in human affairs, they do so with complete
impunity, right? That there's no fallout for them, and the fallout is what happens to the humans. And the way, the kind of term or the sort of epithet way that that's expressed is that the gods are called bloodless. So they can be wounded, but they can't bleed, and they don't bleed. And humans do, and if they bleed too much, they die, right? But that's just not the case for the gods. And so that lack of consequence, or that lack of mortal consequence, is moral, but it's also explicitly understood in physical terms with the loss of blood.
Interesting. Okay, so Matt and Abby are going to have to duck out soon. So do you have something more to add or contribute? Or should we just thank you for your presence here on Creature Chat?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to say. Thanks for hosting. And I'm going to head out. But this was really interesting.
I feel like you dropped that horse boning knowledge bomb.
Don't worry. I'm looking through the notes I have on my computer from the class, but I left my Indo-European textbook and all of the notes from the class, like my physical notes, back in Chicago. So I'm trying to see if I can find what I was talking about. Don't worry.
I imagine myself like imagining the person saying, "No, I swear I didn't bone the horse. I was just watching."
I want to say it's like a Sanskrit poem. Like, I can't remember exactly. Like, I'm gonna find it. I will. I'm on the mission.
Do not Google.
I love that it's a translation issue where somebody's like, "I translated it this way," and they're like, "Oh, I translated it this way."
Yeah. Well, the whole Proto-Indo-European like translation, it's all hypothetical. Like, the entire language is a hypothetical language, so there's a lot of interpretation. But I'm gonna head out. I gotta go play D&D. So thanks for hosting, like I said, and I will talk to you guys later.
See ya.
Speaking of D&D, bye Abby. Speaking of D&D, I'd just like to add that in vampire power in the old D&D was to drain people's levels. Not just energy, but like the whatever accomplishment you've achieved in power. Rich. Power. Yeah, that was pretty bad. I'm glad they went away from that.
Yeah, that's probably kind of an unfun game mechanic to lose your progress in that way.
Yeah, you could lose up to 2 levels, and if you're like a level 2 character, you will just die if you get to level 0. So, yeah, great.
Yeah, so Matt, did you have something you wanted to say, or should we say goodbye to you as well?
I have many things to say, and I'm glad I was able to join your chat, and hopefully more in the future. It was a lot of fun, but enjoy your vampires, everyone.
Cool, thanks for joining, and hopefully we'll see you on future episodes as well.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, I still want to talk about sunlight for a bit. Like, that's a thing that's often associated with vampires very strongly, that they can't bear to be in the sun, and that it either burns them or kills them outright.
Well, yeah, corpses are, like, petrified corpses are not very happy with sunlight either, are they? So, if we want to channel Matt and his way of looking at things, that's probably also just a thing where if you assume the corpses, they would be not last very long in the sunlight.
I mean, they are technically dead, right? So I would assume, yeah, the sun would just kind of expedite any sort of degeneration.
No, that's interesting. I've never thought about it that way, like that it's like kind of like just being like a rotten thing that can't be out in the sun.
Yeah, that is really.
But I think it also depends on like which story or source you're looking at. Because like in the Anne Rice novels, some of the like more ancient vampires, there's one that will run outside in the sun to get a tan and then run back inside. Whereas like the more newer modern vampires in the same universe, they're not as strong as ancient vampires, so they can't withstand any sort of sunlight kind of thing.
yeah, that's kind of a theme that it varies as well, like how recently they fed or how powerful they are, if they can withstand the sunlight. But I just think about this because with the Twilight movies and the books, I think there was a lot of like those movies or stories get a lot of flack for the way they depicted vampires, because people were like, that's not how vampires are supposed to be, because like the vampire in Twilight would just like sparkle in the sunlight instead of burning up to a crisp horribly.
Yeah, which it is a weird choice,
and I think the movies kind of did it injustice. I never read any of the books, I only saw the first movie, but that take on it is kind of a nice fresh idea, because those vampires are all trying to blend in and into society, you know, as part of us. But like in the sunlight, it gives them away, because it gives them, I don't know, almost like a Maillard glow, if that makes sense.
I think it's so fucking dumb. So
well,
dumb.
It's getting past a constraint in the story that you want the girl, the main protagonist, to be able to go to high school with vampires, but you can't, because no high school is like in the evening, so
night school, yeah.
Night high school, yeah. But I like that when we look at the whole thing with the Twilight vampires, it's just that they are basically like they made into like statues of themselves, like frozen in time, like statues. And also, if you kill them, they basically look like statues getting pulled from each other. I like that bit of it, and that then it sort of makes sense that the minerals in their skin sort of reflects light, sort of. But yeah, it is.
It's still dumb. I'm sorry, but I can't accept Twilight into my heart.
No, are there established rules on, like, I've been reading a lot of medieval like theories about the resurrection and how you get resurrected in perfection and like what that meant. But are there any rules on like physical repair when you get turned into a vampire? Like, is that something that's pretty canonically established, or is it something you're like, oh, they turn into, they become like calcified, or they become, but like, do you, like, if you are missing a finger, like, do you get the finger back when you turn into a vampire? Or are you like, just, you know,
I think some stories, it kind of like you're preserved in the perfect state when you were transitioned to a vampire.
Yeah.
So like cuts and stuff like that, and your hair, like, you'll heal yourself or your hair will grow back to what it was. I don't know about like regrowing limbs.
Yeah.
Because like you think a lot of stories, they talk about like decapitation is like one of the few ways to get rid of a vampire, I guess.
Yeah. Because I remember, like, I know that's like Interview with the Vampire rules, right? Because Claudia is like forever a 6-year-old, but I'm thinking about like, Cassidy, again, in Preacher. I don't know why Preacher has become such a like point of reference for me for this chat. That's kind of weird. But
oh, yeah, I forgot
where
about
he just
that
gets one. Blown to pieces, and then it's like he eventually, like, if he has enough time, he can like reconstruct himself. But I guess
like
that's like
Wolverine, kind of like that kind of very strong regeneration power.
Yeah, where he's like he's basically regrowing a lizard or something, but like. Yeah.
Yeah, and you make a good point too with Cassidy, because like he does go in the sun, like he wraps himself up, but pretty much like the sun damage just looks like, I don't know, like his skin was radiated almost, mm-hmm. but it doesn't destroy him.
Yeah, yeah, like sort of blisters and becomes flaky, and but
yeah.
Yeah, I definitely want my vampires to be damaged by the sun, but I don't I'm not completely dogmatic about it that they can't go in it at all, but I think it should be something that they fear and hate, because it like ties them into the night even more.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's nice to think that there are limitations, isn't it? Like, yeah, they have to be, it has to be a, they have to get nerfed a little bit.
Yeah, they have to have some sort of weakness. Can't be just like Superman.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I think sunlight is, if you could just try to think of it as like what does sunlight symbolize in general? A lot of cultures is also
truth.
Truth, you know, holiness, some
life
sort of
itself.
Yeah, life itself, divinity. So it's a flip side of life being dead, death, and vampires are really good, you know, sentient, you know, embodiment of death, right? So I think that you also have to have that as like the lore reason why sunlight specifically is so bad for vampires, because they revile everything that is part of
good
life.
And holy, and like, yeah they can't stand it. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like the picture of Dorian Gray, where like his true form is on the painting and he can't bear to look at it, and like maybe that sunlight is like in the clear light of day, you would see yourself, and they can't see themselves in the mirrors at least, or like what they've become, that they're always like cloaked in darkness, and like they kind of maybe hiding from their sin or their like all the wicked things they've done.
Yeah, God in Christianity and Judaism is also a sun god, is like lifted off of Egyptian mythology. So in that sense, the vampires would also, you know, shy away from God's presence, so to say.
Yeah, and there's also that association with God and truth, I suppose, that they can't bear the crosses either.
But yeah, I don't know what the thinking behind silver? Because werewolves hate silver too, and I know, is it just that it's
usually... that was just werewolves.
It's pure and untarnished, yeah. Kind of, but I mean, it does get tarnished, but you can, it's shiny and pure, I suppose.
And then like, it's also sanitary. Silver is quite sanitary. It's like, there's a whole thing where you can actually eat silverware without cleaning it, without getting sick from it, whilst other metals are less so. So,
I think copper as well is very, it has antimicrobial properties, that like the handles in hospitals are of a copper alloy usually.
Mm-hmm.
And they found some sort of beneficial effects from that.
Also less expensive than silver.
Yeah. But I mean, people will still go into like construction sites and steal the copper wiring out of the walls if they're left unguarded for too long.
Or abandoned houses, yeah.
Yeah, so.
For sure.
Is it because it's not an alloy? Is that correct? Is silver not an alloy?
Yeah, it's not an alloy, but that would make the same thing for gold. And I don't think gold actually has that property. So I think there's something special about silver that I can't really put a finger on.
Yeah, because it's just like very beautiful as well. At least like that shining kind of pure looking metal as well. That like as we associate clear skies and clear water with good things as well.
So yeah, so we have silver. We have crosses, holiness. That's other holy stuff like holy water, holy ground, stakes. Stakes are very common at least. And
I think we went over that with the origin stuff as well, that they were used to like nail the corpse into the grave that they couldn't get out of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's a cool sort of trivia origin for it.
Yeah, you ain't going nowhere.
Yeah. I guess often now that I think this is at least in Buffy and Vampire the Masquerade, that if you stake a vampire, they'll just like disappear in a puff of ash, like turn into ashes from being staked, and that's a more of a modern convention, I suppose, but I like the idea of nailing them into place more.
I'm actually, Peter, in Vampire the Masquerade, the true lore about it is that you actually don't get turned into dust if you get staked. You get put into torpor and look like you're completely dead to the outside world.
I might have been misremembering, because isn't in the video game at the start of the game they stick you through the heart and take you captive?
Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
For sure, it's fine, it's completely fine.
I'm so sorry, Patrick, I've failed you.
in that specific lore, I'm pretty well versed, so.
I think maybe I was thinking of Blade, maybe they turn into ash in that, not sure.
Yeah, silver stakes. There.
Yeah, but what is it with garlic, though? Why is garlic a vampire repellent? Is it just because it's so strong smelling, or what?
Isn't it also antiseptic?
I think that's it, yeah.
And yeah, and you sort of believed in miasma and stuff like that in olden days. So the whole idea of something smelling would also be the sign that it was working or had some sort of power.
Oh yeah,
that's an interesting. And also, they would use like a smell. It was like a smell battle, right? So you would put a nosegay or a pomander or whatever under your nose in times of plague, because if your nose was filled with that smell, that like the other, you know, the plague couldn't get in. According to National Geographic,
they were on the right track a little bit, but not strictly scientific. But yeah.
According to National Geographic, rabies can help explain the supposed aversion of vampires to garlic. Infected people with rabies display a hypersensitive response to any pronounced olfactory stimulation, which would naturally include the pungent smell of garlic.
Oh, that's cool.
Interesting.
Yeah, about the smell battle, I think I heard that malaria also just like means foul air, and because they thought that it would catch it from places with a lot of foul air, like swamps and stuff like that, but it was actually the mosquitoes breeding in swamps that spread the malaria. Oh, still spread it.
Yeah, miasma. So yeah. Yeah, I've learned a lot about vampires.
Yeah, this has been super fun, but I do feel the energy going down just ever so slightly. So.
Damn you, Colin Robinson!
Yeah, I think we can begin to start wrapping up a little bit. So, thank you.
I do want to say...
Oh, please do.
No, I was just going to say, because this was a fucking super fun conversation. But I know Varley said something about he almost wants to do an Anne Rice
reread.
So if anybody is interested in possibly doing that, maybe we'll consider doing like a Anne Rice book club on the vampire series.
Oh yeah, heck yeah.
That does sound fun.
Sure. Yeah, also, I know, Peter, you've said it a few times, the Vampire Bloodlines game, but... If any person hasn't played Vampire's Bloodlines yet, and they don't mind a bit janky combat, they should really play Vampire Bloodlines, the video game.
I've always meant to.
Is this sequel coming out, isn't there?
Sorry?
Is it going to be a sequel, isn't there?
Yeah, it's delayed indefinitely, so we don't know. But yeah, we won't speak about that.
Yeah, this game that we're talking about, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, is from 2005 or something, I want to say, maybe. And it's a very very good RPG that has a lot of good dialogue and options for non-combat progression, that you can persuade NPCs instead of killing them often, or sneak past them, and it's a fun, a good sort of alternative RPG, and with a lot of cool horror elements and good world building as well. Highly recommended, even though it is a bit old and buggy, but you can get a mod for it to fix some of those bugs.
Actually, if you buy it on
all the Black Isle Descendant games companies are plaguely making RPGs, like In Exile, Obsidian, and Torch Games, the ones that made Vampire the Bloodlines Masquerade.
Yeah, Troika Games, they went like under mid production, but yeah, you can get it on good old games with the patch installed in the game, so you don't even have to think about that. So it's
convenient.
Yeah, so go get it if you like to play that game. It's really good.
Okay, well, thank you all for joining me for this episode of Creature Chat on Vampires, and this was super fun. Do you guys have any other upcoming podcasts that you would like to advertise here?
We're doing another seminar of Ice and Fire next Sunday on monsters, so it will tie in nicely, one imagines.
Yes, okay. I'm looking forward to that, definitely.
Me too. And apparently I'm also being part of some sort of Anne Rice reread, so so yeah, look forward to that.
Nothing official yet?
It's official.
And do you guys have any ideas for a future episode of Creature Chat that you would be interested in? We've talked a little bit about the werewolves today, and I think Abby expressed interest in doing an episode on werewolves, so that's on the list. But any other ones you'd be interested in?
I like the idea of the animophobia one.
Oh yeah, I have it down here as Jeepers Creepers Animal Beef or Phobia Cast.
Yay! I was going to reiterate my call for that one. Just like problems with animals. Issues with animals.
Yeah, it would be nice to have Marie on that one, as she has been quite vocal of her dislike of many different animals and mushrooms on the Discord.
So, that or elves and fae creatures. I like as well.
Oh yeah, fairies would definitely
A fae creature chat would be cool. Yeah.
I will put that on the interest expressed part of my list.
I did put a fae in the document, but
as we are often talking about fairy tales, that would be most appropriate, definitely.
Well, for this cast, the Balvansai.
So the Scottish vampires?
Yeah.
I didn't know about them, but I saw them on the dock. They look really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, they share their name with the villains of the Star Wars universe, but I've not heard the Balvan Scythe either.
Yeah.
What sort of properties or what kind of story is that of the Balvan Scythe?
Well, they're a kind of fae that protects the forest from hunters, so they can turn into wolves, crows, ravens, and rather than Western vampires who use fangs, they use their nails, and they're always women, and they trick hunters into getting near them, then they cut open their necks with their talons.
Oh, cool. So there's kind of that siren connection there as well.
Yeah. And then they suck your blood.
That's where we get the term banshee too, right?
That's Irish, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Irish.
Oh, okay.
Isn't a banshee like the ghost of a scorned woman or something like that that's always screaming? Banshee wail is a term in popular culture, I'm sure.
Yeah, etymologically banshee and baban she are related, like that they're comparable in Scottish and Irish. They have deer feet. Oh my god, they sound so cool. I can't even know about this.
Kind of like a fawn or a satyr, I suppose.
Oh yeah.
Wow. Yeah, okay. That's also a thing we need to talk about.
Yeah, that's that has a lot of overlap with fairies as well, but I do have beastmen down here on my list as well. That might be a topic for minotaurs and centaurs and satyrs and fauns and harpies and things of that nature. But I guess they're just sort of those human animal hybrids, basically.
Yeah, I mean that's a very a Warhammer-esque categorization of the animal, of the monster.
Why I never.
Okay. Well, yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm sure we'll have topics for creature chats for months to come. I'm sure.
Yay.
I'm happy about that. But okay, I'm gonna start wrapping this up now. So, thanks all for joining and. Maybe I'll see you on the Zoom call later on. Bye.